Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Starting Anuchet number 97. Tadeta Bhagavata Eva Sarva Vedar Tattvam Darshitam Tatra Ragyak Prashnaha. Thus it has been demonstrated that all the Vedas refer to the personality of Godhead. In this regard, there is the king's question. King asks a question, and that king is Bhriksha. Sri Vishnu Rata Uvacha Brahman Brahman Yonir Deshiye Nirgune Gunavrittaya Katam Charam Tishutaya Sakshat Sad Asatapare. Sri Bhriksha said, O Brahmana, how can the Vedas directly describe the Supreme Absolute Truth who cannot be described in words? The Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature. But the Supreme is devoid of all these qualities, being transcendental to all material manifestations and their causes. This is the beginning of the 87th chapter of the 10th canto, the prayers of the personified Vedas. Jiva Goswami explains, Asyartaha. The meaning of this is as follows. Shrutayastavad shabdamatrasya sadaranyad guneshu sattvadishu vitir yasam tadrishyo drishyamte. The Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature. The Shrutis are seen to act within the modes of goodness and so on, because they share the common nature of all kinds of sound. In other words, sound describes material things. The Vedas are sound, therefore how can they describe what is beyond matter? Doubt. How can they possibly describe the Supreme? Brahma tu nirgunam sattvadi gunatitam tasmad eva anirdeshyam. Brahman, however, is nirguna, beyond the modes of goodness and so on. Therefore, it is impossible to describe in words. Tat tat guna karya bhuta jati guna kriyakyanam gunantaranam abhavaspadatvat tadrisha dravyasyap aprasidatvat adirdeshyam satvadi karya bhutabhyam sarasabhyam karya kalagnabhyam padam iti tena tena asambandam shityartaha. Well, that's a big sentence. This implies, I've divided it up into a couple of sentences. This implies that Brahman cannot be described in words because it does not have any of the differentiated features which are derived from each of the basic modes of nature. These features are species, quality, and action. Jati, guna, and kriya. This comes from Vaisheshika philosophy. All existence is divided into certain categories. There are substances, and then substances have qualities, and they also have motions, movements, and they also have jatis, or generalities. Just like cowness is in all the cows. A cow is a brown cow or a white cow. Those are specific qualities. But the general quality of cowness is in all the cows. So that's a jati. So those are the things that are described by words. Substances and qualities and actions and generalities. But Brahman is beyond all these. It doesn't have any such, Brahman doesn't have any such differentiated features, which are derived from each of the basic modes of nature. Indeed, there is no known precedent for such an object. Brahman, there's nothing like it. Nothing that's ever been described, anything like Brahman. And being beyond the sat and asat, the causes and effects, which are produced from goodness in the other modes, Brahman has no connection with these effects and their causes. That has nothing to do, Brahman has no connection with the products of the material world, nor of the modes of nature from which all those products are created. So how can the Vedas say anything about Brahman? That's Parikshit's question. Okay, some commentary on that. Parikshit Maharaj asked this question after hearing from Shukadev the most extensive narration of the Supreme Lord's pastimes. He asked it at the end of the 10th canto, after hearing all the leelas. Now he asks, how could a supreme be described in words? He has heard a lot of words. Now he's asking. Other Puranas, the Mahabharata, and some other scriptures present similar accounts of Krishna Leela, but none so thorough as that in Srimad Bhagavatam's 10th canto. Now, curiously, Parikshit seems to question the very possibility of doing what has just been done, the depiction of words of the absolute truth. Language is nothing more than a symbol system for describing objects in the world of duality and the processes of change that happen to them. The absolute truth, however, is untouched by duality and changeless. How then can even the perfect Vedas say anything in words about the absolute, especially since the Vedas themselves declare the supreme to be unknowable and indescribable? Okay. According to Vedic scriptures, everything in this world evolves from combinations of the three modes of material nature. Entities created from the modes are knowable and describable because they belong to identified categories and have identified qualities and effects. They're knowable and describable because they belong to categories. They have qualities. Brahman may also be a real entity, but it is not created or identifiable in any terms of jati, guna, or karya. It wasn't created out of those things, and it can't be identified with them. It exists, but it cannot be known by thought couched in language. Or so say the impersonalists, whose assumptions about the Supreme are seriously wrong. Parikshit Maharaj, of course, does not really subscribe to this view. Otherwise, why would he listen with such enthusiasm to the whole Bhagavatam up to this point? He must have been asking this for the benefit of others, just to set the record straight. Okay, any comments? Sorry, Apurva.
Said that it's a smiling face of the Supreme Person of God because it describes this personal activity. And before approaching the 10th canto, we have to read the first 9 cantos. And practically, it was already established the nation of the Absolute Truth, Krishna, in the previous 9 cantos. And then, because Maharaj Parikshit, he listened to this, he must have already understood that. So, what is the meaning of further mentioning this nation about Krishna? Is it so bewildering?
Well, now we're going to hear it from the Upanishads themselves. Bhagavatam explains itself with different demigods and persons offering prayers have explained this. But we're going to hear it from the supreme authority, the Upanishads, and the Vedas. The Vedas are going to explain how what their connection is with the personality of Godhead. That's the purpose of the prayers of the personified Vedas.
Yes.
The thesis has already been proven. It's already been proven and established, but this is extra evidence coming from the highest authority.
So, how to understand this? Is this a real what happened at some point of time, these prayers, or just Bhagavatam put some, what to say, take some verses from the Upanishads and then.
I don't know if it's supposed to have actually happened. We're not told that it didn't actually happen, so why not? Except that one morning the Vedas woke up Narayan and sent these prayers. Why not? Yes?
It's possible to...
I guess so. We're not giving any reason why not. Yes?
I didn't understand two statements in the translation. The Vedas, second line probably. The Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature.
This is Pariksha talking.
So what is the Vedas? Vedas are limited to describing the symmetries of nature.
Guna Vritaya. This is Prabhupada's Anyway, the phrase is Guna Vritaya. The Vedas are Guna Vritti. What the Vedas refer to are the gunas. So the Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature.
But Vedas are describing things beyond the material nature, so that's the purpose of the
Not
Vedas.
According to this Purva Paksha. This is a Purva Paksha.
Oh, okay.
It's not Pariksit's real opinion. He's speaking on behalf of the impersonalists.
Okay.
Who assume that anything that can be described in words is material. Okay? Yeah, readers of the Bhagavatam shouldn't be confused and think that Pariksit really thinks that. Even if he did, he's going to change his mind by the end of the chapter. Even if it's an aberration, it's a temporary one. But it isn't. He's just saying it because people think that. He's speaking on their behalf.
So the glass we are given for the also full of options, that means the Shrutis are seen to act within the modes of goodness and so on, because they share the common nature of all kinds of sound. What is the
This is Jiva Goswami's explanation of Pariksit's phrase Guna Vritaya. He's expanding on it. How is it that the modes are referring only to the modes of nature? Because the Vedas are language like other language, and language in general only can describe phenomena, things that are knowable, that can be put into categories and given names.
So even taking this as a Purva Paksha statement, how they are saying that the Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature, what authority they are saying in this statement?
This is the theory of the Advaita bodies.
But
they take it on the evidence of statements of the Upanishads. Yato Vacho Nivartante Aprapya Manasa Saha. The absolute truth cannot be described in words or known by the mind. So, of course, they misinterpret that statement and take it too literally. But they make that is one of their assumptions. The absolute truth is beyond description by words.
So that means they are saying
Shruti
and Smriti are material song, like there is a basic foundation.
I'm sorry?
Shruti and Smriti are just material song, but their only source of information is.
Shruti and Smriti, what's that? I'm sorry, I just don't hear it.
Material song.
their sound. To a Mayavada, there's no such thing as spiritual sound or spiritual anything. It's pure spirit, according to Mayavada, has no form. Sound is a form, is a duality. Sound is always consists of dualities. If I say cat, it's not dog. If I want sound, if you hear one particular sound, it's not another sound. It's a duality. But there is no duality in the absolute truth. So there isn't any sound in the absolute truth.
So how they can get liberation from sound, that is, if it's Shrutis or Vedas, if they are not spiritual, like it's ordinary material?
Well, that's our argument. That according to them, you know, they are actually denying the authority of the Vedas by saying the absolute truth can't be described in words. Then what the absolute truth is talking about is just Maya. What the Vedas are talking about is just Maya then. So their whole epistemology of accepting the authority of the Vedas as the means of knowing becomes invalid, because the Vedas don't describe the absolute truth. They only describe material things. What's the use of the Vedas?
So why they are saying that the Vedas are limited to material qualities of material nature? For what reason? Why they assume like that?
In order, because their first axiom is that the absolute truth has no qualities. There's no duality, no qualities in the absolute truth.
They study the Vedas, and
therefore, to support that first axiom, they have to take it very literally that words cannot describe the absolute truth.
Okay.
If you allow words to describe the absolute truth, then you're putting the absolute truth in the realm of duality.
Okay.
If he's black, then he's not white.
Yeah, but this is about the absolute truth. But what about why they have to say the Vedas are limiting to the modes of material nature?
Because, I'll have to say it again,
okay.
Same thing, that they have a basic axiom that the absolute truth has no qualities. Therefore, the second corollary of that first assumption is that words can't describe the absolute truth, otherwise you're giving qualities to it. If words can't describe the absolute truth, then the Vedas are words, they also can't describe the absolute truth. That's the argument.
Because it cannot describe the truth, it is material, that's the...
Because it's words, it's material.
Okay. But then why they are studying the truth is so...
Ask them, I don't know.
I've
the Buddhists don't. The Mayavadis are just covered Buddhists. The Mayavadis are hypocrites because they pretend to accept the authority of the Vedas. At least the Buddhists are honest about it and don't accept the authority of the Vedas. The Buddhists are more honest. The Mayavadis are hypocrites.
Because we hear the statement that by realizing the statements of the Vedas, one can get liberation.
Yeah.
The Mayavadis
say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they don't accept the absolute authority of the Vedas. For them, the Vedas are just some relative authority, like a deity of Vishnu who's just an illusion. You know, so the foolish people can worship the deity, and the people who are a little smarter can study the Vedas, but ultimately they're stupid also, because the Vedas are also illusion. And the only people who have, you know, fully realized and have become Brahman directly, they're the only ones who really know. And they're beyond words, they're beyond deities, they don't have any duality, and you can't say anything about them.
Parikshit is asking a very simple, straightforward question. Well, Vedas not able to display the absolute truth. And Shukadeva Goswami is taking the indirect answer. First, he is referring to the same question what was asked in the Madhikashrama. Then again, he is taking back to the Mahaprabha Kumaras or something. Then again, he is taking back to the Vedas. So,
yes.
It's like a cyclic argument.
Cyclic?
Argument.
No, it's not a cyclic argument. What he's saying is that this question that you're asking me was already asked before and answered. So let's trace it back to the original time it was first asked and answered, all the way back when with Sanat Kumar and the sages were discussing it. And then Sanat Kumar told about this prayer, these prayers offered by the personified Vedas. The question was asked before, I'll tell you the answer that was given back then when it was asked before. That's not cyclical. There's nothing wrong with
that. It's also speaking.
Who?
Vedas.
Right, and therefore the Vedas are going to explain how they can describe the Absolute Truth. We'll hear from them, from their own words. And the Vedas do speak words, that we can't deny that. What we can deny is whether the words are authoritative. So let's hear the Vedas, they'll explain themselves.
What is this answer of?
Well, either you accept the authority of the Vedas or you don't. If you don't, forget it. Nothing we can say. If you do accept the Vedas, why don't we listen to what the Vedas say? If you don't accept the Vedas as authority, well, you got a problem. If you do accept the authority of the Vedas, well, look, here's what the Vedas, this is what the Upanishads say. And they're explaining how they describe the Absolute Truth. How they can. That's the purpose of these prayers of Prasanna Vedas, to let the Vedas explain how they describe the Absolute Truth. Yeah.
Not by what they accept the authority of Buddha Sutra, and I think it's the last sutra on the British of Dhamma, the British of Dhamma. I think I was repeated that liberation is from the sound. So how do they interpret it?
Well, see, they're trying to accept the authority of the Vedas. They accept the authority of Vedanta Sutra, but Vedanta Sutra is simply a commentary on Upanishads. So before you accept the authority of the Vedanta, you should be accepting the authority of the Upanishads. Otherwise, what's the use of Vedanta? If it's a commentary on a book that's unauthoritative. But the Upanishads are accepted as authoritative, therefore we're interested in hearing the commentary on them. So that's the Mayavadi's assumption, but it's self-contradictory. It's contradicted by their assumption that the Absolute Truth can't be described in words. And they come up with some makeshift explanation that the words point indirectly to the Absolute Truth. Like, you know, you can't actually show someone, you know, somebody wants to see the moon, well, you can't grab the moon and give it to him, but you can point behind that tree there, that tree tip of the tree trunk, tree branch, there's the moon. So by pointing to the tree that's close by, you can get the person to see the moon. Indirect showing. So they say the Vedas are indirectly showing us the Absolute Truth.
So is it called the Chandra Shaka Nyaya?
Chandra Shaka Nyaya, yeah. And that's the idea of Lakshana Vritti, or indirect reference. But we get problems. Something cannot refer indirectly unless the words you use have, first of all, literal meaning. The Vedas have to mean something before they can indirectly refer to something else. So, you know, then you have to, you know, then there are all sorts of arguments of what are the Vedas actually saying then? What are they saying literally?
So does it mean that
And then the Vedas here are going to tell us in this chapter of the 10th canto what they say, what they actually have to say. The Vedas are explaining themselves. In the form of offering prayers, they're explaining what they're actually talking about.
Does it mean that what Vyavaja wants to say, that they, for example, okay, they follow this practice, this meditation, this deity worship, some kind of mantras chanting, so they follow Vedic injunctions. Then, at some point, because this is important to them, is Saguna Brahma. But then they come to some particular point in which they can get some liberation from the highest level and describe Saguna Brahma. Is it what they
That's what the Mayavadis are thinking, that the Upanishads will reveal to you Saguna Brahma. And that, you know, then you'll somehow, just by magic, you'll graduate to near Guru Brahma. That's their idea, yeah. But it's also fallacious. It's assuming that near Guru is superior to Sanguna.
that nirguna is the real thing and saguna is just imitation. That's not true. Rather, these poor Mayavadis who are suffering in nirguna realization, and hopefully they can graduate to saguna realization, which is more complete. But they have it backwards. Okay, yes.
Mayavadis are saying that it is indirectly referring to the absolute truth.
Yeah.
But how that is proves that Vedas cannot speak about absolute truth according to their requirement.
They've already established that the Vedas can't describe the absolute truth directly, because the Vedas consist of words. Words describe dualities. Absolute truth doesn't have any dualities.
That means the tree is inside the duality. The Chandrashakane, the tree is a duality inside, and the moon is like absolute truth.
Something like that, yeah. The moon is supposed to be the absolute truth that you can't point to directly.
Yeah, but still it is only goes to the tree, but the moon is cannot be...
Yeah, but how do you actually get from the tip of the tree to the moon? That's the puzzle. How do the Vedas, how do they manage to indirectly point to something that can't be pointed to? The moon is also a duality, so you can't point to it. Although it may be hard to find, or hard to describe where it is. It's easy to say it's behind the tree. It's not really behind the tree, it's billions of miles, you know, quarter of a million miles away. But you can say it's behind the tree just to orient the person to see it. But the moon has a form. Brahman doesn't. So how can you apply the same process to Brahman? How can you point to it even indirectly if it has no form, no location? Yeah.
So of course it's explaining actually what they really mean, that the mercy of the Guru Brahman, they can get realization and they are satisfied him according to it, by following this worship of Guru Brahman.
Okay, but they're depending on the mercy of something that doesn't exist. They're depending on the mercy of Nirguna Brahman. There isn't such a, there is no such thing. Brahman is never devoid of qualities. They're bored with Saguna Brahman, and they're praying to Nirguna Brahman. They don't realize that Saguna Brahman is the only Brahman that's there. That's the reality. And they're ignoring it and praying to something that doesn't exist.
And the prayers itself is so easy, manifestation of duality, because they stay worship in somebody, they have to reject
duality. Yeah. Yeah, Krishna's there, everybody's worshipping him, we'll humor them and we'll pretend to worship him also. They don't realize Krishna is it. There is no other absolute truth. Yeah.
Small comment. It is amazing that we just by contact with Srila Prabhupada and Guru Parampara, we cannot understand how these people can believe such things.
Yes.
Because then it seems to be like a silly philosophy which had no real foundation.
Yes.
But these people are considered to be quite intelligent in the material world, and they wrote a lot of books which are highly considered in the academic environment. So you can see Maya Bhakti Dhyana,
they are Krishna. Well, Maya has that power. This Mayavad philosophy is a very addictive poison. Like illicit sex or something, you know, something like that, very attractive, or heroin. You know, once you get hooked on it, you're addicted. And so the world is addicted to this Mayavad philosophy. We're very lucky. We were saved. Either we were cured of it, or somehow we avoided getting infected.
From the other side, we have such a simple faith that sound can describe the
absolute truth. Yeah, we refer to Prabhupada. Prabhupada tells us things, and they're obviously true.
Yeah, I mean, we can just simply know that. But other people who speculate about it, they cannot go behind And so I cannot describe something which is immaterial. I cannot go out from this point.
And even if they try to accept the authority of the Vedas, they can't really do it. They can't really accept the authority of the Vedas. Especially when the Vedas tell them, Ishvara Paramam Krishna. They can't actually accept it.
There's an appearance there, Shankaracharya.
Shankaracharya? Really? Okay, so we've had some glorification. He's specially empowered to bewilder us. Krishna's order to him, and to increase the unwanted population by spreading this pernicious philosophy. So anyway, did we finish the paragraph?
Yeah.
Did we read the commentary? Okay. This chapter is not going to be discussing Mayavada philosophy. It's not going to dwell on the question. It's going to move on to the Vedas explaining themselves. This is just to get the conversation started. But it's not what the conversation is about what the Mayavadis believe and why they believe it. It's a silly Purva Paksha, but it's going to be answered. Let's read the next paragraph. Now, we come to the conclusion at the end of this that, the end of the first paragraph. Well, Brahman has no connection with material modes, so it seems problematic that the Vedas are supposed to be able to describe Brahman. This is the doubt. How can the Vedas describe Brahman? It doesn't seem possible. Okay, so now there's some further argument from that viewpoint, doubting that Brahman can be described by the Vedas. Tatacha sati, yata dittavachi, kasmin chit advitiye dravye, tatshabdasya mukya vritti pravartite. Such being the case, in the way the word ditta, somebody's name, refers literally to a certain unique thing called ditta. Or in the way that yatacha simho devadatta ityatra gaunya vritya shaulya guna yukte devadatte simha shabda pravartate. This is literal reference. That's ditta. That's his name. So it's ditta directly. Direct reference by his name. Or you say devadatta is a lion. Well, that's not literal, but it's what's called Gauna Vritti. There's Lakshana Vritti, but this is a subcategory, or sometimes it's considered a separate category. Gauna Vritti is when you describe something according to its, you identify something with its quality. When you say David Dutta is a lion, you mean he has a lion, he shares quality with the lion. So the similarity is based on a quality. That's called Gauna Vritti. Or you may say, Yata cha gangayam kosha itya pralakshana vritya ganga shabdas tasmin itya sambande tate pravartate. Or in the way when you say the cowherd village on the Ganga, the word Ganga refers by metaphor or lakshana vritti to the shore which is connected to the Ganga. So there's a connection, not of quality but of something else. There's a physical connection between the shore and the Ganga. It's the shore that's approximate to the Ganga. That's what we call lakshana vritti. So direct reference, Gauna reference and Lakshana reference. Three different kinds. But tata tat tat abhava aspade brahmani taya taya vritya shrutaya katam pravarte ran. But how, in the same way, can the shrutis refer to Brahman by either of these three kinds of reference? Since it's devoid of all these features. Brahma doesn't have a name. Jitta or anybody, anything else is not, you know, Brahman Sharma. He doesn't have a name. He doesn't have any qualities, so you can't say he's a lion or anything else. And he doesn't have a connection with anything else. He's not next to something else that he can be called, that he's on the Ganga because he's near the Ganga. Because he's not near anything. So Brahman cannot be referred to either directly or figuratively or by qualitative similarity. Well, that's all the way, those are the three ways that words work. There's no other way. So words can't describe Brahman. How come the Vedas, which use words that operate in these three modes, none of those modes work with reference to Brahman? How come the Vedas describe Brahman? Shruti nam cha shastra yoni twat iti nyayena tat pratipadakatayam ananyayam tatra pavitir avashyam vaktavya. Yet we cannot avoid admitting that the Shrutis are the only means of giving information about Brahman. According to the Sutra of Vedanta, shastra yoni twat, because scripture is the source of knowledge about it. So somehow we have to accept or explain that the Vedas can describe Brahman. And all the more so since the Shrutis are self-evident authority. It especially must be acknowledged that their words refer to Brahman literally. Svatat pramananam chatasam mukhya pravittis tu visheshato vaktavya. The Vedas are self-evident authority. They don't need to be explained or supplemented by anything else. So what the Vedas say about Brahman should be so literally, not even just figuratively. Let's give commentary on this. The commentary says, the reference of words to things in this world can be extended beyond literal designation, but only within certain limits. Poets and philosophers of language in the Brahminical tradition of scholarship recognize three modes of reference, called abhida, literal, lakshana, metaphorical, and vyanjana, suggestive. Metaphorical usage is furthermore subdivided into lakshana according to similar quality and according to any other connection. The first one is called gauni, and the second one is just regular lakshana. Two kinds of metaphor. Metaphor based on quality, metaphor based on some other connection, some other similarity. Ditta and Devadatta are imaginary persons often used in analogies with Sanskrit linguistic logicians. Here the first of the two is literally himself, but the second one, Devadatta, is only figuratively a lion. Devadatta shares a lion's quality of courage. In the third example, the Ganga's shore, where the village actually sits, is connected to the river by being adjacent to it. Poetic suggestion can also be discovered in the expression, the village on the Ganga, the figurative reference of the river implying that the atmosphere of the village, like that of the river, is cool, and sanctified. King Kurukshetra is now arguing, however, from the impersonal assumption that the absolute truth has no form or qualities. So he's talking like a Mayavadi now, Kurukshetra. It is not nameable by Abhida. The absolute truth is not nameable by Abhida, direct reference, nor does it have characteristics by which to compare it to anything else nameable. So there's no point of comparison, so there can't be any figurative reference. The king's guru, Shukadeva, however, is not going to allow him to maintain this assumption at the cost of denying the authority of the Vedas, which claim to give information about Brahman and are in fact the only authoritative source of information about Brahman. In the first few sutras of the Vedanta, the proposition that Brahman can be identified meaningfully as the source of all known existence is supported by the statement Shastra Yoni Twat, which is the third sutra in the Vedanta.
The Supreme can be known because the revealed scriptures provide that knowledge. See, that's said at the beginning of the Vedanta, because unless you can accept that fact, there's no sense saying anything more. We're going to comment on the Upanishads to explain Brahman, because we're assuming that they are the source of knowledge about Brahman. If they're not, no sense continuing with Vedanta Sutra. We might as well stop after two sutras. The Supreme can be known because the revealed scriptures provide that knowledge. And because the Shrutis are not dependent on sensory perception or logic for verification, their reference to Brahman is literal. When it says Brahman, it means what it says. Because there's no other point of comparison. There's no other sensory perception that he can use to modify your understanding of what the Upanishads are saying. They have to be taken literally. Nor can logic extend the meaning of the Vedas. What they say has to just be taken on face value. Before figurative usage can be taken up, there must be some previous empiric knowledge, like that of lions, on the basis of which Devadatta can become a metaphorical lion. Before you call Devadatta a lion, you have to have some idea what a lion is. You have to have known of lions. Impersonalists in the Advaitavad school believe that the Shrutis only point vaguely in the direction of Brahman by Lakshana, and that to factually know Brahman, one must first become a fully realized soul, oblivious to all duality, including the duality unavoidable in all language. There's an unavoidable duality in any language. This presumption belittles the importance of Shruti as a means of objective knowledge, subordinating its reliability to private experience. That means what's really important for the Mayavadis is this mystic perception you get when you go beyond all words. The words themselves are not so important. So you can study the Vedas or you can study some comic book. It doesn't really make a difference. The words aren't important. What's important is that you get zapped in the head and you get the realization. Okay, comments?
Vedas are the authority, and by only the basis of the Vedas we can know. But still, our own senses are not spiritual. We are influenced by the three modes of human nature. How we can understand the Vedas and by which?
Well, this is an important question, but it's not on the topic. This is opening up a whole different question. How can people with imperfect senses understand what the Vedas are saying? That comes by the mercy of the Absolute Truth, by the mercy of the Vaishnavas who are presenting and explaining the Vedas. By their mercy, we can understand them properly. Yamai Vaishav Vinatayate Nalabhyas. When the Absolute Truth chooses to reveal himself, when he's pleased with someone, then that person can know and can understand the words of the Vedas. Only then. Okay, but that's a different topic. That's not what the chapter's talking about. Yeah. Yes.
About this mystic revelation, which is superior to all the Vedas. So we might have like two persons who so called got this revelation. So one person's revelation is perfect, and then another one is perfect, but they are a bit different. So
different?
So, yeah, different. So
we can't
judge it, because if we judge it according to the Vedic injunctions.
Not only can the two peoples have, for the I'm talking as a Mayavadi. You can't have two self-realized souls with different realizations. First of all, you can't even have two self-realized souls. If they're self-realized, there's only one of them. There's only one of them, and he's not schizophrenic. So there's only one proper view of the Absolute Truth. There can't be different views because there can't even be two different people who are self-realized. If they're self-realized, they're not separate people anymore.
So they say, yet,
well, that's for those who are in ignorance.
You know, you can approach the absolute truth from any direction. But those who are actually fully realized, as Krishna says in the Gita, for those who are fixed in self-realization, there's only one view.
How can we know what is this? How we can even describe what should be this kind of realization they achieve?
Well, if someone who is self-realized comes down and shares his wisdom with you, you're fortunate. Otherwise, you can't guess.
But also in the same way, how can he explain? Because it's impossible to explain this relation.
No, he can't explain, really. He doesn't give it to you by explaining, but just... you can just hit you on the head and knock some sense into you. The Guru, just by his mercy, by showering down mercy on you, he'll give you realization of the absolute truth. It's not a matter of words.
Maybe therefore they are worshipping so intensely to the spiritual master, like...
The truth as expressed in words hasn't have any value anyway. They just worship the Guru as Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu. Guru is God. And, you can become God too if the Guru gives you his blessings. So by any device you can, get those blessings. Okay, this is the last comment? Okay, thanks for the last comment.
The last statement, this presentation belittles the importance of Shruti as a means of objective knowledge. What is this understanding of objective knowledge like?
Yeah. Well, that the Shrutis can actually tell you what's the way things actually are, not just the different people's opinion about what it might be. Objective knowledge is, unquestionable fact that doesn't depend on someone's opinion, how someone feels about it. It's just the truth. That's objective. Subjective means you feel like this, I feel like that. I like Crofton. The other guy hates Crofton. It's just a matter of personal opinion. But, to say that Crofton is made out of these ingredients, that's objective fact. It doesn't matter whether anybody likes the taste of it or not. Yes?
What's the logic of this commentary? Like, first, the question is, Brahman is beyond... Brahman cannot be compared to any other object, or it cannot be... all these three are without all these things.
Where is that?
In Android, somebody said, I didn't come to this statement.
No, you had to point to me. Show me where you read this.
It is second paragraph.
Yeah.
It is not nameable by Abhita or the certain characteristics by which...
Well, okay.
Yes, this is the logic. And that means we have to prove that the government has qualities, etc. But suddenly we are shifting the logical connection to the Shrutis. And later, and because the Shrutis are not dependent on sensory perception, so that is a different kind of subject altogether.
I don't exactly understand. I mean, here Parikshit is presenting the Purvapaksha.
Yeah.
He's presenting the Mayavadi way of looking at it. That's going to be answered by showing that, your Mayavadi can have your opinion, but the Upanishads have their opinion, and it's completely different than your opinion.
Okay. So
the Shrutis have no problem describing the absolute truth. They have plenty to say about the absolute truth. And the problem is with your Mayavadi assumptions.
So the statement...
But we start off by laying down on the table, here's the Mayavadi assumptions, that's what they say. And then the Shrutis say, you can say that, you Mayavadis, but we say something different.
So this statement is starting from mind, because the Shrutis are not dependent on sensory perception.
Because the Shrutis, where is it? Because
the middle of the second paragraph of the commentary. And because the Shrutis are not dependent.
Well, okay, see, starting with the sentence, the king's guru, Shukadeva, however, is not going to allow him to maintain this assumption. From that sentence on, we're answering the Purvapaksha. This is what the rest of the chapter is going to do. King Parikshit's still talking. But as soon as he's done talking, Shukadeva's going to start answering. And he's going to defeat the Purvapaksha. And not by saying, this Purvapaksha is stupid, whoever said it is stupid. No ad hominem attack. He's simply going to show that the Vedas don't agree. And we care about what the Vedas say. So rather than, you know, show 150 ways why the Mayavadis are stupid, Shukadeva's not going to do that here. He's just going to say, well, I know, you know, I remember, you know, when they were discussing back in the Tapaloka, they were talking about what the Shrutis said. Let's see what the Shrutis have to say about it. That's how he answers the Purva question. So the answer begins with this sentence, the king's guru Shukadeva, however.
So how did he get to answer this statement of, and because the Shrutis are not dependent on sensory perception, so all logical qualification, they reference to Brahma's literal, this one statement in connection to the previous Purva question.
Well, okay, like, if we make a statement, Devadatta is a lion. Okay, I look at it and say, no, he's not a lion, he's a human being. You know, a lion, I wouldn't shake a hand of a lion, but Devadatta is not going to bite my head off. I know he's not a lion. So your sense of perception denies that he's a lion. But then the explanation is that, well, okay, but he's a lion because he shares the qualities of a lion. It really means he's lion-like. So logic is explaining, because there's a logical connection of being similar to something else. It's a logic of similarity. There's a connection by similarity. Even though A is not the same as B, A is similar to B. So there's a connection of similarity. That's logical knowledge acquired by logic. But you can't talk logic about Brahma. You can't do the same process to extending your understanding of a statement about Brahma. A statement about Brahma that the Upanishads give us, if you're a Mayavadi, can't be extended by logic because Brahman can't be analyzed in logical terms. It doesn't fit into categories. It can't be said to be similar or not similar to anything else. So the Mayavadis can't use Lakshana Vritti. They can't actually figuratively refer to Brahman because they can't analyze Brahman in logical terms.
Yeah, this is the
Purva Paksha,
but my question is, sorry, my question is...
So that's the answer to the
Purva Paksha. Yeah, I understand. But my question is, how is this statement, and because the Shrutis are not dependent on sensory perception or logical verification, the reference to Brahman is literal.
Yes.
So, you answered based on what Brahman actually, but here, there is a subject about Shrutis' nature, they are not depending on sensory perception. So, what is the connection between that Purva Paksha and this statement?
Which poor reduction? I'm sorry. But we're not.
The answer is starting from the Vedas, it doesn't depend on logical, logical verification, etc. So, what is the connection? The answer is starting with this point.
The answer to the Purva Paksha is basically an assumption that the Vedas do describe the Absolute Truth. Now we have to understand how they can describe the Absolute Truth. The Purva Paksha was proposing that the Vedas can indirectly point to the Absolute Truth. But here we're arguing that no, the way that the Vedas describe the Absolute Truth has to be direct. Because the Shrutis are not dependent on sensory perception or logic for verification. Okay. Well, okay, maybe there is a something incomplete there.
That's the beginning of the answer, so suddenly I was thinking how the whole thing, what is the connection with the Purva Paksha?
Okay.
I agree that the logic of this, you know, the argument in this sentence may not be obvious. Why is it so that because the Vedas are not dependent on centering, that, okay, that I have to think about.
Yeah, because the subject is here discussing about how the Brahman is cannot be understood.
No, we're not discussing, see, we're not talking. We're just, the Purnabhaksha, we're finished. It's not Pariksha talking anymore now, it's Shukadeva talking.
Yeah, the Purnabhaksha is finished, but the answer
now is the answer is that the Purnabhaksha's assumptions are wrong. The absolute truth, the Vedas do describe the absolute truth. Now a point's being made, and they describe the absolute truth directly, literally. Now there may be something not clear about the reason why that I gave in the sentence. But we're not arguing the Purnabhaksha anymore. We're putting it aside.
Okay.
Your Purnabhaksha is there, but it's based on wrong assumptions. Yeah. You're assuming that the Vedas can't describe the absolute truth. It can.
Yeah.
Now the question is, how do they describe the absolute truth?
Yeah.
At that point, we get a little confused.
Yeah. In this paper, this understanding of what I wanted, thought of the connection, how it suddenly starts. But I think later.
Well, what happens here is that Pariksha just says, okay, you got your Purnabhaksha, but we're not going to take it too seriously because it's based on false assumptions.
Thank you.
We'll go back to the assumptions. Your assumption that the Vedas can't describe the absolute truth, that's not right. Let's show you how the Vedas do describe the absolute truth. Rather than deal with the nitty-gritty of the Purnabhaksha, we just say, well, your Purnabhaksha doesn't make much sense because you're starting with the wrong assumption. Okay, now I have to make a comment here. What the logic here isn't obvious in that sentence. It's not obvious how one thing leads to another in that sentence.
Yeah.
I'll have to think about
the
that.
The whole subject is starting without any connection to the Purnabhaksha. Like immediate connection to the Purnabhaksha.
Okay. Hare Krishna. Okay, we're over time by 10 minutes. We'll continue this tomorrow. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada and Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, got it.